coming up on Star Stuff. Spooky sciences quantum physicists create light out of nothing. The debate heats up over claims that neutrinos have been recorded travelling faster than the speed of light. And all systems go for the launch of the Mars Science Laboratory mission to the Red Planet. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Scientists have used the spooky properties of quantum physics to literally make something out of nothing. Researchers, including Professor Tim Jutte from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, used a strange phenomenon called the dynamical Casimir effect to force a mirror to make its own light rather than simply reflecting the light around it. The study, reported in the journal Nature, uses the weird science of quantum fluctuations in which virtual subatomic elementary particle pairs continually pop in and out of existence in a vacuum. Jutte and colleagues were able to then scatter one half of these virtual particle pairs before they could reconnect and annihilate each other, popping out of existence again. By forcing the virtual particles to scatter, they became real. And that's where the dynamical Casimir effect comes in. It allows scientists to generate a virtual photon particle. However, to achieve this effect, the mirror needs to be moving at almost the speed of light. Now, in practical terms, that's impossible. It would take the output of a nuclear power plant to accelerate a mirror to such high velocities. So instead, scientists used a tiny microcircuit called a superconducting quantum interference device, or SQIB. SQIBs can be made to act like tunable electronic mirrors for virtual microwave photons, causing some to become scattered in the real world before they can disappear again. When they did this, Jutte and colleagues found the mirror then started radiating some of its own photons in microwaves. According to Jutte, it's a bit like shaking a sealed box, then opening it, and suddenly a flash of light appears. The real photons produced out of these virtual photons in the experiment collectively retain a particular quantum signature which ordinary light doesn't have. Jutte and colleagues measured strange correlations in the microwaves. Basically, they found waves at one frequency correlating with waves at another frequency, and that simply doesn't normally happen for classical microwaves. The new research builds on an earlier experiment called the static Casimir effect. This describes the force generated when virtual particles are squeezed out as two boundaries which light can't get through, such as, say, mirrors or metal plates, are brought closer and closer together. Now, eventually, they become so close without touching that it restricts the ability of some quantum fluctuation particles to pop into the space between the mirrors. Now, because there's no such restriction on virtual particles popping in and out of existence outside or beyond the mirror boundary, they generate a force, pushing the two mirrors even closer together. And that force is real and can be measured. Jutte says while the static Casimir effect does this in three dimensions of space, the dynamical Casimir effect that he's achieved does this in the dimension of time.
It's an experiment that started out some time ago with some theoretical physicists, some mathematical physicists who were trying to understand some problems that are connected to gravitation and how to do this really interesting theory of quantum mechanics, which has been around for about 100 years, but how to mix this up with some really hard problems like gravity. And when they were examining this theory, they came up with several things that seemed like paradoxes or strange glitches or strange kind of non-intuitive, let's say, results.
Dare we say spooky science?
Well, just the weirdness of quantum mechanics, which comes out in the quantum weirdness that we have been dealing with for about 100 years. And so this particular effect was a kind of a thought experiment that if you could move a mirror, well, what happens? Well, a mirror reflects light. And in the original idea, people conceived of this as, you know, mirrors, because it's very easy for us to think in terms of mirrors because we operate, you know, with visible light as our sensors, and we get up every morning and we look in to the bathroom mirror, or we shine flashlights when you're a kid into the mirror and have fun with things with laser beams nowadays. But the original sort of idea was, well, you know, what happens if we have this mirror and we start moving it really, really, really quickly? Because since Einstein, we've known that moving things quickly, there's a speed limit called the speed of light. And if this mirror was moving so fast that it was near the speed of light, you sort of ask yourself, now, what happens if I imagine I try to shine a light into the mirror or it bounces off the mirror? And that led to this question, well, you don't really need to shine light at the mirror. If you move it fast enough, it will start to create its own light.
Why?
Why that is? Well, that's an interesting question. Initially enough, I guess the important sort of thing that motivated this idea, because it was a simpler version of a result that Stephen Hawking came up with back in 1974, which was he was studying black holes. You know, a black hole is this really strange object where anything that falls into the black hole never comes out again. And to everyone's surprise, he figured out that black holes actually evaporate because they radiate light in some strange way. And it turns out...
Well, isn't that because right at the edge of the black hole's event horizon, if you have quantum fluctuations with the photons that coming out in pairs, one may be sucked in, but the other one is still out in the real world and can't disappear again after it.
Yes, and that's completely correct. And in a very cartoon way, that is correct. And the reason that happens is because of the event horizon. But as Einstein sort of argued years and years ago, there's this thing called the Einstein equivalence principle, which says that being in a strong gravitational field is no different than being in some sort of accelerated field, like being in an elevator that's accelerating, so that you can't tell the difference between a gravitational field and being inside some object that's undergoing acceleration. So that's what links this Hawking radiation, in which pairs of photons are produced, and one of them gets away and one of them is eaten by the black hole. Mathematically, it's the same process as what creates light in our dynamical Casimir effect, which is about accelerated mirrors. And I guess the Hawking radiation came first, and people maybe thought, well, there's probably some easier ways to think of this problem and to deal with it mathematically. That's when this dynamical Casimir effect was described by the mathematical physicists as a type of thought experiment or a sort of way to analyze the problem in a much simpler situation than at the event horizon.
When you think about the quantum fluctuations that we're talking about here, it's so mind-boggling to think of basically nothing there, but there is still literally a bubbling froth of photons popping in and out all the time.
Yeah, so the vacuum is not empty, and that has a lot of important consequences.
Even nothing has something.
Yeah, and that's what's really strange. And there are other aspects of this problem in quantum physics, and one of them is we like to call a zero-point motion. So even if you cool an atom down to the very, very lowest temperature possible, there's still the electron's still jiggling around. And there's even though the electron is sort of bound by the nucleus, it still has some motion, even at zero temperature. And this quantum uncertainty is a very similar effect to the fact that there's this zero-point motion of these particles that come in and out of existence.
So you know roughly where they are, but not exact.
Well, you know they're there, but they don't really last long enough to do anything with usually. So in the experiment, effect we achieve is to actually suck some of those out and give them a longer lifetime, essentially, to where they actually can behave as if they were free and flying around.
Are we looking at long-term applications, or is this better understanding the pure physics of the universe we live in?
Well, I think it's more better understanding the physics, and it's like I said, it's an effect that we know should be there, and it's just been hard to actually show that it's there for a number of reasons. And so that makes it interesting. So it's really basic physics. One of your questions was, how do we know that the microwave photons we see are produced by this effect? And the answer to that is we measure these strange correlations in the microwave. So you look at one frequency and you see it's correlated. The noise in one frequency is correlated with the noise in another frequency, and that normally doesn't happen for classical microwaves. And so actually measuring that and convincing ourselves and other people that we measured that correlation was the real difficult part of the experiment.
That's Professor Tim Duty, a physicist with the University of New South Wales. Scientists have again timed neutrinos travelling faster than the speed of light. Physicists carried out the second test to try and eliminate some of the doubt cast on their methodology in their original experiment, reported in the Pre-Press Physics blog archive on September the 23rd. In the original oscillation project with emulsion tracking apparatus test, or OPERA for short, scientists fired weakly interacting subatomic particles called neutrinos from CERN at the European Centre for Nuclear Research in Switzerland, some 732 kilometres to the Italian Gran Sasso laboratory northeast of Rome. Much to their surprise, they found the neutrinos covered the distance 60 nanoseconds faster than the 2.3 milliseconds it would have taken a photon travelling at the speed of light to cover the same distance, meaning the neutrinos apparently travelled some 6 kilometres per second faster. At 299,792,458 metres per second in a vacuum, the speed of light has until now been considered the ultimate speed limit of the universe. Nothing can travel faster than light, making it one of the great foundation stones of physics underpinning modern thinking of how the universe works. The original results, reported back in September, were greeted with shock and skepticism by the scientific community, including the OPERA researchers who conducted the experiment. While publishing their results, they called on other scientific research facilities to repeat the experiment independently in order to get their own findings and see how they correlate with the OPERA results. Physicists involved in the experiment said they had checked and rechecked their results over 6 months in order to determine if there's anything that could have produced a misreading before announcing what they found. Scientific peer review, an important part of research, has already led to a multitude of papers published in response to the findings, many of them questioning the results. The new experiment conducted by the OPERA team was designed to exclude one potential systematic effect raised in the original test, which may have affected the original measurement. Namely, how could you tell which neutrinos you were actually timing? The September findings were the result of 15,000 neutrino beams pumped over 3 years from CERN to Gran Sasso. One potential source of error in the first results was that the pulses of each neutrino beam sent by CERN were relatively long at around 10 microseconds each. So, measuring their exact arrival time at Gran Sasso could have had a relatively large margin of error. This time round, scientists altered the structure of the proton beam hitting the target at CERN, which is producing the tau neutrinos. The modification helped the team identify individual particles when they fired out and when they arrived at their destination. The beams this time were around 3 nanoseconds shorter, with a large gap of 524 nanoseconds between each beam pulse. Now, this meant scientists at Gran Sasso could time the arrival of the muon neutrinos more accurately. However, the new test hasn't eliminated concerns over a possible GPS satellite timing issue raised by Ronald van Elberg from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. Elberg says the test was timed using GPS satellites, with scientists treating the GPS clocks as if they were on the ground rather than travelling at orbital speed in space. The OPERA team accurately gauged the instant the neutrinos were created and the instant they were detected using clocks at each end. But keeping those clocks exactly synchronized, according to Elberg, is far more tricky than it seems. OPERA used GPS satellites transmitting highly accurate time signals from orbit. But he says the team also needs to take into account the time it takes the GPS signals to travel from the satellite to the ground. So has OPERA overlooked the relativistic motion of the GPS satellites? From the point of view of a clock on board a GPS satellite, the positions of the neutrino source and detector are changing. The detector is moving towards the source, and consequently, the distance travelled by the particles, as observed from the clock, is shorter than the distance measured in the reference frame on the ground. That difference adds up to an error of 64 nanoseconds, which coincidentally almost exactly matches what the OPERA team say they observe. In the United States, scientists at the Fermilab Particle Physics Laboratory said the new experiment still failed to resolve questions as to whether the flight of the neutrinos had been accurately timed, as just the tiniest error would skew the whole findings. Jenny Thomas from Fermilab's own neutrino experiment called MENOS says the OPERA observations of a similar time delay with a different beam structure only indicates no problem with the batch structure of the beam. MENOS produced similar results to the OPERA results back in 2007. However, those experiments had a significantly larger margin of error. Meanwhile, scientists involved in the Icarus project who have been examining the OPERA results have rejected the OPERA findings, saying their tests had shown the OPERA findings were wrong. Icarus, another experiment at Grand Sasso, says their measurements of the opera energy on arrival contradict the reading. In a paper posted on the archive website the same day as the opera results, the Icarus team say their findings refute the superluminal, faster-than-light interpretation of the opera results. They argue on the basis of recently published studies by physicists that the neutrino pumped down from CERN near Geneva should have lost most of their energy if they had travelled even at a tiny fraction faster than light. They argue that, based on studies, the neutrinos pumped out of CERN should have lost most of their energy if they had travelled at even a tiny fraction faster than the speed of light. But in fact, the Icarus scientists say the neutrino beam, as tested in their equipment, registered an energy spectrum fully corresponding with what it should be for particles travelling at exactly the speed of light and no more. Physicist Tommaso Dorigo, who works at both CERN and Fermilab, says the paper prepared by the Icarus team is both simple and quite definitive. It states the difference between the speed of neutrinos and the speed of light can't be as much as that seen by the OPERA team based on the energy levels recorded, and is certainly smaller than that by at least three orders of magnitude, making it compatible with zero. Meanwhile, experiments are being prepared at both Fermilab and the KEK laboratory in Japan to try and replicate OPERA's findings. Only confirmation from one of these would open the way for a full scientific discovery to be declared. For now, at least, scientists say it's still too early to claim Albert Einstein may have been wrong when he wrote his 1905 special theory of relativity, which concluded that nothing can travel faster than light. That would force a major rethink of theories about how the cosmos works. And it may even open up the possibility of neutrinos taking shortcuts by travelling through as yet unknown additional dimensions. NASA has delayed the launch of its Mars Science Laboratory mission to the Red Planet by 24 hours. The postponement was called to give technicians time to remove and replace a flight termination system battery. The flight from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida will now take place during a 1 hour 43-minute launch window, which will open at 15:02 GMT on November 26. On board the Atlas V rocket is the $2.5 billion car-sized Curiosity six-wheeled rover. Built by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, it's the biggest rover ever to travel to the Red Planet. It's equipped with video cameras, laser beams, drills, and a sophisticated built-in laboratory for analyzing rock samples and soils. After a 570 million kilometer flight taking 8.5 months, Curiosity will land at Gale Crater, just south of the Martian equator, in August 2012. Meanwhile, as part of events tied to the launch of Curiosity, the CSIRO's Canberra Deep Space Network is hosting its first ever NASA tweet-up. Tweet-ups allow ordinary members of the public invited to the tracking station to report on the launch using Twitter and talk to some of the scientists involved in the mission. Spokesperson Glenn Nagel says NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory have already used tweet-ups for important events, including the final shuttle launches and several space exploration missions.
A tweet-up is an informal meeting of people who use the social messaging medium Twitter to actually get together, and rather than just talking to each other online, is to actually meet face-to-face for the first time and actually get to discuss, you know, one of their favourite subjects. And in this case, we're talking about science.
We've had a couple with NASA and the final space shuttle launches and a few other rocket launches as well.
Yeah, NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory have been doing tweet-ups quite successfully for quite a few years, bringing together maybe 100, 150 people to actually witness an event. And what makes the tweet-up different to other ways of getting information out there is, in the past, it's been the idea of, you know, you put a media release out for an event and you hope that a media outlet picks it up and then reports it to the public. The idea of a tweet-up is to actually get the public to report an event to the public. And actually, that works out in such a great way because it allows people to talk in layman's terms to other people who understand things in layman's terms about an experience. It makes it quite a first-hand experience rather than just getting something from some scientist, some boffin somewhere.
Surely the scientist has a role in all this. You'd want a scientist to be available to say, give it that expert viewpoint if he's asked or if she's asked.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the other great features of a tweet-up is bringing the scientist to the actual people coming to the tweet up. We call these people tweeps. So these are people who use Twitter. And so they talk to the tweeps, and the tweeps can ask questions of the scientists to learn a little bit more about, you know, in this case for the landing of the Mars Science Laboratory, the kind of work it will do. So we'll be talking to some of the geologists there. We'll be talking to other people who have worked on other planetary missions and our exploration of the solar system. So this is a first-hand way to actually have a face-to-face with those scientists, not just waiting for them to report it to you, but to you, as an ordinary person, to actually ask those penetrating questions.
Any special guests?
So for the launch, what we're going to be doing, the launch for us, of course, is happening very early in the morning. It's 2:21 a.m. and scientists will be busy, you know, with their spacecraft and getting that ready. But we've invited a number of local people who have worked on that particular mission and others, including Marian Anderson from Monash University, who was part of the teams looking at the selection of Gale Crater on the surface of Mars and the kind of research that they may want to do in that geology. We're also talking to Dr. Trevor Ireland, who worked on the Japanese mission Hayabusa, which returned samples from the asteroid Itokawa last year. We've also got Dr. Ravi Sood, who is a balloon atmospheric researcher. He does a lot of work with sending experimental payloads into the high atmosphere, to the very edge of space. And then we have people like Dr. Paul Tregoning and Dr. Daniel Shaddock, who are working on a NASA mission called GRACE, which was a gravity mapping mission of the Earth. And the spacecraft now is going into an extended mission. So we're talking to people like these who are right at the coalface of the exploration of space. And it'll be just a fantastic opportunity for the ordinary public to actually talk to these people and then get their messages out on Twitter.
How do you become part of this Twitter Sphere event?
All you have to do is actually, when the event is actually on, we've selected our 50 people who will be coming along to that, and these are people from all over the country. In fact, we also have somebody coming all the way from California from this event, and people can follow along by just going onto Twitter, if they're a registered user already, and using the search hashtag, and then just put in CSIRO TweetUp. So it's CSIRO TWEETUP, and then that will find all of the messages that go out, because that's the key thing about Twitter. You put on a little special hashtag that allows anybody to follow us anywhere around the world. Yeah, and I'm sure you can also find it through ABC Star Stuff.
That's Glenn Nagel from NASA's Deep Space Communications Complex in Canberra. As the United States prepares for the launch of Curiosity, Russia, meanwhile, is continuing to struggle with their efforts to bring the Phobos Grunt Mars mission back to life. Phobos Grunt was to be the first ever sample return mission to the Martian moon Phobos. But after a smooth launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan, Phobos Grunt suddenly went silent after reaching orbit. It failed to conduct two scheduled engine burns, which were designed to take it out of Earth orbit and send it on its way to Mars. Mission controllers in Moscow have been struggling ever since to try and regain control of the wayward spacecraft. However, with battery power failing and a decaying orbit, mission managers are fast running out of time. If they haven't gained control of Phobos Grunt in the next few weeks, the 14-ton spacecraft, including its 12-ton load of highly toxic fuel, will re-enter the Earth's atmosphere and come crashing back to the surface in an uncontrolled fireball. And time now once again to turn our eyes to the skies and check out the night sights on Skywatch. Les Dalrymple from the Powys Museum Sydney Observatory is a contributing editor to Australian Sky and Telescope. He joins us now to study the heavens and a rather disappointing Leonid's meteor shower.
It only happened a day or two ago, but you really didn't miss that much. It came and went on the night of the 18th and the 19th of November. It's one of the best-known meteor showers due to its association with really huge meteor storms that were observed back in 1833, in 1866, and in particular in 1966. Now, these particular storms saw rates of thousands of meteors per minute were observed over fairly short peaks, so they became really quite famous, with a very, very high proportion of bright fireballs as well. would be just like watching fireworks, one of the most spectacular things you could possibly imagine. But in between all of those years, the shower tends to be pretty quiet to moderate.
Now, meteor showers are usually caused by the Earth going through the debris field of a comet or something. And, of course, that's what this particular case is all about, isn't
it?
Yeah,
indeed. The Leonids come from the debris train left behind by a periodic comet, a very, very well-known periodic comet called Temple-Tuttle, which comes around every 33-odd years, and that's why we see the gap that I just spoke about between those showers, 1833, 1866, and then 1966, 100 years later. But in between, when we don't cross exactly through the centre of the stream, we see less impressive displays, and that's what we saw this year. It peaked on the 18th, and what was observed worldwide was around about 10 or 12 meteors per hour. A respectable display, but nothing like the storms of the past. So, certainly still worth seeing. On the last time that Temple-Tuttle went past, which was back in 1999, there was a close encounter with Jupiter. Now, it's been expected that that has slightly altered the orbit of the comet, and in fact Rob McNaught's been doing a bit of work on that, but it's very unlikely, it would seem, that we're going to see any major storm activity from this particular shower for many decades because of the alteration of its orbit.
What do we know about this change at this stage?
Well, we don't know that much because we're probably going to find out the next time it comes back. It will be in about 33-odd years, but there will be a subtle change to its orbit, which will likely have the result in moving the stream of material, which is falls out of the back, basically, of the comet, out of the direct path of the Earth. So it may be the end of the great Leonid storm.
Let's see what happens. Anyway, let's take a look at some of the constellations in the night sky for this time of the year.
Yeah, well, one of the most prominent constellations in the whole sky, and probably the best known after the Southern Cross, is the constellation of Orion. Because it's a very big constellation, it has an unusually large number of bright and colourful stars. The time to look for it is in the northeast in the late evening at this time or in December, not long after sunset. Orion houses an incredible number of very bright stars. The sixth and the eighth brightest stars in the sky, Rigel and Betelgeuse, are in Orion. And the next five brightest stars in Orion, Bellatrix, Saif, Alnitak, Alnilam and Mintaka, are all in the top 60. So it is, all up, the brightest constellation in the night sky. Just heading on to its two brightest stars, if you find the three stars which are in a row which form Orion's belt, and they are Alnitak, Alnilam and Mintaka, if you look towards the south, which is up towards the sky which is above you, you'll find Rigel, which is distinguished by its cold white colour. Some people even describe it as being slightly blue. It's the brightest in the constellation, around about 20 times the mass of the Sun. It's about 850 light years away and more than 80,000 times brighter than our Sun. And if you go in the opposite direction from the belt stars, in other words, down towards the northern horizon, you'll find a star with a remarkably different colour, a deep orange star by the name of Betelgeuse. Now, Betelgeuse...
Don't say it three times.
And it's got a bit of bad press rate lately. Back around about 6 or 8 months ago, there was some material in the media which speculated on whether Betelgeuse was just about to explode or whether it was going to happen in 2012. The truth is, we don't know, but...
You've got to love those 2012 scaremongers, don't you?
Look, you know, there's so many conspiracy websites out there which talk about how many different ways we can be killed, but Betelgeuse is about 550 light years away, and it is perfectly true that this is a star which is going to expire in astronomical time frames fairly soon. We're talking about sometime in about the next 500,000 years. Could be tonight, could be next week, could be next month, could be in 478,000 years' time. We just don't know. That's all there is to it. But that beautiful red, deep red colour comes from the fact that it's got a much cooler surface than Rigel, because the star is much, much bigger. In fact, if you place Betelgeuse in the solar system in place of the Sun, the surface of the star would reach almost out to Jupiter. It is that huge.
And, of course, the other big thing happening at the moment is everyone's getting ready for another eclipse.
Yeah, in fact, the second this year, and we're really, really quite privileged that this year we're going to have two lunar eclipses. Everybody will remember we had one back in July, back in the wee early hours of the night. This one's a little bit more favourable to look at. The eclipse starts very, very late in the evening on the 10th of December. It's a lunar eclipse, so what that means is that the moon will be passing into the Earth's shadow. So if you were standing on the moon and looking in the direction of the sun, then the sun would appear to pass behind the Earth, so it would get dark. And because of that, the Earth's shadow passes across the moon, it gets much, much dimmer. But the eclipse starts at around about 11:46 when the moon starts to move into the Earth's shadow.
Now, this is Sydney time, of course, Eastern Summer Daylight Time.
That's correct. The total phase of this eclipse, unlike the one that we had back in July, is relatively short. It's all over in just 50 minutes. The one that we had back in July was nearly 2 hours. The reason why this one is so much shorter is because the moon is physically about one-third of the size of the Earth's shadow at the distance at which it lays. And it doesn't always go exactly across the centre of that shadow. And on this occasion, it actually skirts just inside the southern side of that shadow. And if you're interested and you're in Sydney, Sydney Observatory is running an open night. So if you're interested in visiting Sydney Observatory and going and looking through the eclipse through our telescopes, why not give Sydney Observatory a ring and visit us on our website, which is at sydneyobservatory.com.au.
That's Les Dalrymple from the Powys Museum Sydney Observatory, a contributing editor with Australian Sky and Telescope. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.